Hello, it's Wednesday the 22nd of December and welcome to another edition of Career 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-ho. The government is set to secure an additional 6,900 beds by next month for serious COVID-19 patients as part of efforts to counter further hikes in infections. We'll have more in our news briefing shortly. Earlier this week, the government announced plans to spend 2.4 trillion won next year to double the number of eco-friendly cars on the roads. We'll take a closer look at the plan and assess the growing EV market for our in-depth today. And then on Korea Book Club, we'll be talking about a short story by Gong Ji-young, a renowned writer of the so-called 386 generation. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. The government has unveiled plans to expand the number of hospital beds through next month as the number of severe COVID-19 patients continues to tick up, reaching a new high. For more on this and our key headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday to you too. So the government is aiming to bolster its supply of hospital beds for serious COVID-19 patients to ensure that the healthcare system won't be taxed, particularly in the case that we see daily caseloads continue to increase to the 10,000s. So how many beds exactly are in the works?
Well, according to health officials, Jang-ho, the country currently has roughly 15,000 COVID beds for serious patients, and they are aiming to expand that by some 46% by the month of January, with the more ambitious goal being procuring a total of 25,000 such beds. The plan is to designate 6,900 additional hospital beds for serious patients by next month, and the pool of medical staff for these patients is to be expanded by inserting military and public health doctors. Public institutions such as the National Medical Center and the Seoul Medical Center will suspend general practice to focus on treating COVID-19 patients. An administrative order has also been issued for general hospitals, including National University Hospitals, to increase beds for serious and critical cases by 1%. 20 more medical facilities have been designated to specialize in COVID-19, and beds for less serious cases, some 2,400 of them, will be set up at makeshift treatment centers at university dorms and training centers run by public agencies. Meanwhile, the government has launched a review for emergency use authorization of Pfizer's COVID-19 pill called Paxlovid upon request from the KDCA. According to Pfizer, Paxlovid reduced the risk of hospitalization and death by 88% when given to an unvaccinated person at high risk of severe COVID-19 within 5 days of symptoms showing. It also said lab experiments indicated the drug will attack a key protein in the Omicron variant.
Let's also get an update on the latest COVID-19 count. Where are we in terms of our daily figures?
The daily caseload is back over the 7,000 threshold as the number of critical cases hit another fresh high. The KDCA on Wednesday said there were 7,456 COVID infections throughout the previous day, which is nearly 400 fewer than the same day last week. The number of serious and critical patients, meanwhile, stood at 1,063, the highest to date, eclipsing the previous record of 1,025 set on Sunday. 78 people succumbed to the virus and 7 more Omicron cases were confirmed, raising that total to 234.
Let's continue on and move on to economy-related news next. The finance minister has said the government is preparing measures meant to ease tax burden on those who own just a single home. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, this against a backdrop of spiking property tax loads driven by escalating housing prices. Finance Minister Hong Nam-ki, during a ministerial meeting on the real estate market Wednesday, said supplementary measures under review are aimed at alleviating tax burdens, quote-unquote, to some extent. His remarks come after the ruling Democratic Party said it is, quote-unquote, positively considering similar action. The ruling party and the government are reviewing several measures for homeowners with one home, including applying this year's officially assessed property price in calculating next year's real estate holding tax. The minister, however, put his foot down on a proposal by the ruling party's presidential candidate Lee Jae-myung to temporarily exempt multi-home owners from paying increased property transfer taxes, citing market stability, consistency in policy, and fairness issues. From this year, owners of more than one home who sell their property less than a year from the day of purchase will face a 70% transfer tax compared to the previous 40%.
On to the campaign trail next. Democratic Party presidential candidate Lee Jae-myung announced his campaign pledges in the science and technology sector, including a moon landing project of some sort. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, so at the party headquarters on Wednesday, Lee Jae-myung pledged to complete a moon landing project by the year 2030 and launch a locally developed 3-ton stationary satellite, all part of a wider project of solidifying education and expanding state support for R&D to make South Korea one of the world's top 5 science powerhouses. Lee said that he would establish a deputy prime minister post over science, technology, and innovation authority with planning and budget oversight.
Over at the main opposition party, the People Power Party presidential candidate Yoon Sung-yeol sought to mend fences after party leader Lee Jun-suk resigned from his election committee posts following a dispute with a senior committee member.
Right, that senior committee member's name is, of course, Cho Soo-jin. And about 4 hours after Lee Jun-suk held that press conference announcing his resignation, Cho Soo-jin over social media also announced she would be stepping down from all of her committee posts, saying that she apologized to party members and supporters over party dissonance and that she would continue working for a change of power outside of the committee. On Wednesday, Yoon Seok-yeol, following a meeting with Kim Jong-in at party headquarters, said the general chairman of the election committee expressed the need to tighten his quote-unquote grip on the committee for more efficiency in its operation, to which the presidential candidate said he threw his support. Yoon Seok-yeol is set to embark on a 2-day tour of the southwestern city of Gwangju and the surrounding Cholla region on Thursday, his second visit to the area as party candidate. Among the things he will do, he will visit a hydrogen industrial complex in Wanju, North Cholla province, and also meet with university students before traveling to Saemanggeum Seawall in the provincial city of Gunsan.
Moving on, South Korea and China are set to resume high-level strategic dialogue between their foreign ministries this week after a 4.5-year hiatus.
Last such meeting was held all the way back in June of 2017. A foreign ministry spokesperson saying that First Vice Foreign Minister Choi Jong-kwon and his Chinese counterpart Le Yu-cheng will hold the 9th strategic dialogue virtually on Thursday. The two sides are expected to discuss future-oriented development of their ties ahead of the 30th anniversary of diplomatic relations, as well as Korean Peninsula regional and international issues of mutual concern. The meeting, of course, also comes amid an intensifying dispute between China and the U.S. with regards to Washington and also allies' diplomatic boycott of the upcoming 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics, as well as China and Taiwan relations, conflict, and supply chain disruptions as well.
Meanwhile, South Korea will provide humanitarian help worth $2 million to the Philippines for typhoon relief.
Yeah, this coming from the Foreign Affairs Ministry. It said it hopes the aid will support the Manila government's restoration efforts and that its people can swiftly recover from the damage. The powerful typhoon Rai had struck the country's southern and central parts last week after making landfall on the popular tourist island of Siargao on Thursday. The typhoon claimed at least 375 lives and affected 1.8 million people, including 440,000 who have been displaced.
Continuing on to other headlines, the state antitrust regulator has fined SK Group chairman Choi Tae-won amid allegations that he illegally earned large profits from the group's 2017 purchase of a silicon wafer manufacturer.
Yeah, the Fair Trade Commission on Wednesday slapped an 800 million won fine on the chairman Choi Tae-won and another 800 million won fine on SK Holdings, which of course is the group's holding firm. It also ordered corrective action, but it did not file a complaint with the prosecution. Now, the Solidarity for Economic Reform and others had filed for an FTC investigation into allegations that SK Holdings had purchased 70.6% of LG Siltron, which is LG Group's wafer producer, back in 2017, leaving the rest for Choi Tae-won, who acquired the remaining 29.4% stake at a lower cost from creditor banks, according to the FTC. It is ruling that SK Holdings scrapped initial plans to purchase the remaining stake after Che had expressed his wish to buy them himself. The holding firm also supported Che in the takeover.
That's where we'll wrap it up for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates, Eunice.
You bet.
This week, South Korea announced plans to spend 2.4 trillion won next year, about $2 billion, to double the number of eco-friendly cars on the road. The government's plans come amid a recent rise in domestic sales of electric vehicles. They are on track to surpass 100,000 units by the end of the year, which would be more than double compared to the previous year. To take a closer look at the government's plan and the current state of South Korea's EV market, we're joined on the line now by Cho Jae-hwan, a reporter at Daily Car, an automotive news company here in Korea. Mr. Cho, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First off, can you give us an overview of the South Korean electric vehicle market? What is its current state?
Sure. Well, the year 2021 is the starting point of long-range electric vehicles thanks to Tesla's Model Y and the IONIQ 5 launch here in Korea. We can understand this trend from EV sales figures. According to Korea car sales analysis firm CarEasyU, Tesla's overall accumulated delivery number from January to November is 17,818. That's about 52% increase from same period of the year 2020. Hyundai's IONIQ 5 also becomes best-selling EV in Korea. According to Hyundai Motor Company, IONIQ 5's domestic sales number from January to November is 21,478. Export number is 34,889. Of course, we can meet Kia EV6, Genesis GV60, and other foreign maker EVs such as Porsche Taycan, Mercedes-Benz EQA, etc. I also like to describe this year shows the example moving forward from present to future. And we are expecting to meet more EVs soon.
Right, so we're seeing a lot more EVs on the market and sales are continuing to grow. If I just give some more figures, according to data by the Industry Ministry, the domestic sales of electric cars jumped 106.6% on year in the January to November period. That's over 91,000 units and we could hit the 100,000 mark by the end of the year. What factors would you say contributed to this increase?
Maybe I can explain this to two factors. One is the appearance of new EV-based platform and growing interest of fast charging infrastructure. A few years ago, Hyundai's Kona Electric and Kia's Niro EV became mainstream of EV market in South Korea because they break the barrier of driving range at least 380 kilometers. It means I can drive that vehicles from Seoul to Busan without any charging attempts. But that EVs were made by recycled internal combustion engine platform, and it doesn't have spacious interior space for back row seat passengers. So many people thought EV is not suitable for AV people's comfort mobility. But today, things have changed very rapidly. when Hyundai Motor Group announced its EGMP platform only for pure battery electric vehicles, I saw many people's positive reactions. When Hyundai launches IONIQ 5, which has spacious backlow seat and long wheelbase, I also felt that this is a true competitor of Tesla Model 3 and Model Y. Let me move on to the fast charging infrastructure. Here in Korea, long charging time becomes one of the most inconvenient factors to people who are willing to buy electric vehicles. If we charge our EV to 50 kilowatt output charger, it takes normally 30 minutes to charge battery from 10% to 80%. But these days, Hyundai and Tesla have developed ultra-fast charging stations, which only needs less than 15 or 18 minutes to charge. So I think these major factors contributed to increase the number of EV sales.
Right, so exclusive electric vehicles that perhaps showcase the best of EVs, along with faster charging options, contributing to the rising EV sales. Now, on Tuesday, the finance minister, Hong Nam-ki, announced plans to spend 2.4 trillion won next year to raise the accumulated sales of eco-friendly vehicles, that's electric and hydrogen vehicles, to 500,000 units from an estimate of 250,000 units this year. To this end, the government plans to more than double the number of zero-emission cars subject to subsidies to some 160,000 units from the current 75,000 units. So looking at those plans then, Mr. Chul, what stood out to you from the government's announced plans?
Okay, government's plan of the year 2022 EV subsidies may benefit many people who are hoping to buy state-of-the-art EV and fuel cell electric vehicles. But most of the people who worry about the EV, including myself, are commonly saying you have much more benefit to buy all kinds of EV faster than any others. Why? The upper limit of giving full nationwide subsidy goes down next year. This year, EV prices, which goes below 60 million Korean won, I should say, can get full amount or 100% of subsidies. But next year, price below 55 million won can get full amount of subsidies. So many people can have a benefit of subsidies, but we can expect a growing pressure because of high price spending to buy new EVs. Actually, I'm an owner of 2021 Tesla Model 3 Long Range. When Tesla Korea announces the cost of Model 3 Long Range as 59 million won in February, I said it's a chance to buy this vehicle because it means the standard or full amount of subsidies. It was a very lucky moment for me. But 10 months after, since I bought the Model 3, Tesla's Model 3 long-range price goes up to 69 million won. That's a standard of 50% of subsidies. You never expect this price before. A few years ago, South Korean government has predicted that the cost of EV prices to go lower every year when the supply meets huge demand. But when we look current price of every EVs, we need to have at least 40 million won to buy EVs which has long range, high quality, driving assistant features, etc. When every car maker, including Tesla, to develop its own low-cost battery, we may need more affordable EV in the near future.
Right, so perhaps for now, at the moment, the subsidies do not perhaps go far enough, particularly when the cost of EVs seem to be going up at the moment, not down, as we might have predicted. But until we get cheaper, more affordable EVs with the lower cost batteries, those subsidies, there's something to keep in mind then. What challenges then, knowing all that, lie ahead for the government to achieve its stated goal of trying to double the amount of eco-friendly cars on the roads next year?
It is very hard for a government expecting annual EV sales and creating accurate EV-related budgets for all people living in this region to accomplish government's goal of 155,000 units within a year. I think they need to focus on creating the management of charging facility first to block unexpected power failure and other possible issues. Numbers of EV charging infrastructure are increasing. Still, many charging stations now under construction. This may bring more people to buy more electric vehicles. And this also may create more sustainable future for mobility companies such as ride-sharing and logistics. If the government don't make any plans to have better charging quality service to the public, we have no reason to buy electric car.
Right, so charging a key factor that could perhaps convince more people to take up EVs if there is better charging infrastructure. Let's look briefly overseas as well, because although part of the government's push for EVs is to meet emission goals, another part of that is to increase the sale of EVs around the world as well. The so-called future car sector has been identified by the government as one of three new key economic growth engines, along with logic chips and biohealth. So then, how are South Korean electric vehicles faring in the global market at the moment?
I'd like to express so many positive reactions from overseas. In late November, IONIQ 5 has been named as 2022 German Car of the Year. One of the German Car of the Year officials said IONIQ 5's unique combination of design, efficiency, and driving pressure helped the car earn above average scores across all criteria without showing any weak spots. And IONIQ 5 debuts on latest Spider-Man movie. I heard that movie stars estimate IONIQ 5 reaches leading technology and visually innovative design. A response of leading technology has led Hyundai Motor Company to be named as Manufacturer of the Year on 2021 Top Gear Magazine Award. It also has been named as Car Design of the Year by car designers around the world. There's also positive reactions on IONIQ 5's U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, standard driving range. It goes maximum 488 kilometers or 303 miles after one charge. Kia's EV6 also getting positive reactions thanks to unique design. But so far, there are so many great results coming from IONIQ 5. I think when Kia launches highest performance GT3 next year, you'll get more positive reactions thanks to high acceleration. Genesis brand also becomes viral. The EV concept car, Genesis X, wins the best of the best Red Dot Design Award for design concept. We are expecting more reactions of Genesis' first ever eGMP platform-based GB60, electrified G80, and electrified GB70.
Right. Despite those good reviews for the latest models by Korean companies, currently Hyundai is only around fifth or sixth in the world when it comes to pure EV market share, behind other companies like Tesla, BYD and Volkswagen. Perhaps that could change as the IONIQ 5 and other cars become more available more widely. How can domestic electric vehicles increase their competitiveness in the global market, in your opinion? What more would you like to see?
Yeah, as you know, we are now living in a very connected society thanks to technology. We can access to the web anywhere we want. We can enjoy latest tech very fast because of diverse media platforms. I think people who like to buy EV are the tech-savvy mind, which has these stuff for their lives. So in order to boost the competitiveness in the global market, I think the key point here is to develop multi-strategies focusing on entertainment and living lifestyle for every generation. Hyundai has partnered with CJ E&M to enhance their own video streaming service at the car dashboard to compete with Tesla, which provides Netflix and YouTube. It shows they are planning to build unexpected dashboard design to make the car as a living space.
Okay. And finally, to end on a more general question about the future of electric vehicles, several countries around the world, particularly the EU, are looking to phase out the sale of fossil fuel vehicles by 2035. South Korea is said to be considering such a plan as well. But infrastructure challenges remain, particularly, as we've mentioned already, with charging stations. Do you believe that such phase out and mass adoption of electric cars or other eco-friendly cars will take place within 15 years or 20 years?
On this point, I'd like to emphasize the importance of home charging infrastructure. We can search nearest rapid charging station on the web and any kinds of mobile apps. As an EV owner, I don't have any difficulties finding charging stations. But when we look into apartments, villas, and other types of Korean homes, there are very few amount of home charging stalls within the parking lot. And I also see some internal combustion engine cars parked within charging spot without any reasons. If government has lack of information or putting more charging stores at every kinds of homes, people think owning EV has more stress than proud. We have to focus on premium brand Genesis movement towards battery electric and fuel cell electric. I don't know, this may be a game changer for Korean automotive market, But if Genesis brand successfully launches wireless EV charging station and putting more contents for owners fun and relax, I think Genesis and other Korean brands could emerge as the biggest competitor to Tesla.
Okay, so challenges remain, but perhaps new advances by companies can help get over that. And, of course, the Korean government, as we mentioned, is trying to encourage such advancements as well with support. We'll wrap it up there. We've been speaking to Cho Tae-hwan, a reporter at Daily Car. Mr. Cho, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 9.45 points or 0.32% on Wednesday, closing the day at 2,984.48. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 3.53 points or 0.35% to close at 1,000.13. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 0.91 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,192 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we take a look at some other news stories that have been trending online in Korea today. And for that, we have Walter Lee joining us in the studio now. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jung. How are you today?
So what do you have for us today?
Okay, so we'll talk about the house where President Moon Jae-in will take up residence after he retires next spring. We'll also discuss the penalty that short track star Shim Seok-hee will be slapped with for disparaging her coaches and teammates back in 2018 Winter Olympics. Finally, we'll find out which two K-pop groups have once again collaborated on a song after 16 years.
Okay, so we start with a story related to President Moon and his retirement plans. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so it appears that the construction is well underway of the house that President Moon Jae-in and First Lady Kim Jong-suk will take up residence after the president retires. The presidential office said Wednesday that the outside construction of the residence in Yangsan, South Gyeongsang Province is almost done, adding that the electric and the interior work is currently underway. Construction, which began in April of last year, is set to be completed in late March or early April of next year, just in time for Moon to move in as his term ends early May.
Yes, I understand that President Moon, he sought to build a house in Maegok Village, where he used to live before he took office, but it hasn't quite turned out that way.
Right, not at all. So it's actually being built in Pyeongsan Village, located some 30 kilometers away. The decision apparently came as there was no room to have a building to house security personnel. The president's house is close to Tongdo Temple and about 50 minutes away from Bongha Village in Kimhae, South Gyeongsang Province, which is the hometown of former president Noh Moo-hyun.
Well, you mentioned there Tongdo Temple. That's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, right?
Yeah, it is indeed. So Yangsan City plans to build a roughly 2.5 kilometer trekking trail linking Moon's private residence and the temple. The city is set to devise a blueprint for the trail by May and finish building it around 2024.
Right, so it seems we're perhaps getting a glimpse of President Moon's life after he steps down from office next May. It looks like it'll be quite the haven to get away from it all after it's all done. Okay, let's move on. What do you have for us next, Walter?
Okay, so two-time Olympic champion Shim Seok-hee has handed a 2-month suspension for disparaging her coaches and teammates back in 2018 during the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. The Korea Skating Union on Tuesday announced the disciplinary measure against the 24-year-old short track speed skater, banning her from donning the national uniform until February 20th, or the closing day of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. The union said Shim violated clauses of maintaining dignity and her duty as a national team member.
Yes, we've talked about Shim often over the years, first as a victim of sexual assault by her ex-coach, who has been convicted and is serving time. But in this latest scandal, she's the one in the spotlight for disparaging her teammates. For those who might be hearing about this for the first time, can you elaborate a bit more for us, Walter?
Yeah, of course. So Shim was penalized for making derogatory comments about her coaches and teammates, including gold medalist Choi Min-jong, in text messages exchanged with the national team coach, Cho Hang-min. Now, during the 2018 Pyeongchang Games, Cho was also given a six-month suspension over the incident. Now, the texts were disclosed to the public by former national speed skating coach Cho Jae-bom, who was sentenced to 13 years in prison by the Supreme Court for sexually assaulting Shim on 27 occasions over 3 years. In fact, you and I covered the story just a few weeks ago when the ruling came out.
Yes, actually, in this latest scandal, it wasn't just the derogatory comments. In the text, it also seemed like Shin planned to deliberately take down a fellow Korean racer at an event in Pyeongchang. That couldn't be proven conclusively, but the texts clearly show at least disrespect towards her teammates and coaches, and it's somewhat tainted her reputation. So, Walter, what happens now if Shim is banned from joining Team Korea until the closing of the Beijing Winter Games? It's pretty much a done deal then that she's out of the Olympics, right?
Well, not entirely. So Shim can try to invalidate the union's decision by calling for fresh deliberations by the Korean Sport and Olympic Committee or asking for a court injunction. Attention is now being drawn to what move Shim will make next as the deadline for submitting the final entry for short track skaters that will compete in Beijing will fall on January 24th.
Right, so there is a chance that she could still make it to Beijing, but there are significant obstacles in the way. And even if she succeeds, you have to wonder what kind of mental state she'll be in when she takes to the starting line as well.
That's right.
Okay, we'll leave that story there and move on. What's our final story for today, Walter?
Yes, so South Korean male pop duo TVXQ and boy band Super Junior have once again collaborated on a song after 16 years. According to their management agency SM Entertainment on Wednesday, the new song titled Magical will be unveiled next week with the release of an album, the 2021 Winter SM Town SMCU Express. SM Town refers to the musical collective for the recording artists under SM Entertainment. Magical is an upbeat pop song that has combined the key characteristics of the two second-generation groups. The two groups first collaborated in 2005 for the track titled Show Me Your Love.
Yes, so fans must be eager to check out this new song, not to mention the album you mentioned that will feature multiple artists under the SM umbrella. Can you tell us a bit more about this winter album as well?
Of course. So it will feature a total of 10 songs, including Magical, and double title tracks, Hope from Gwangya, sung together by all SM Town artists, and Dreams Come True by fourth-gen girl group aespa. So it'll really be a mix of K-pop veterans, as long with the new artists as well. So fans new and old have a reason to be excited over the agency's artists and had last year released a winter album of this sort 10 years ago.
Right, so you mentioned that it's dropping next week, but can you give us the exact details of when and what time?
Yes, so for people interested, the album will be released at 6 p.m. next Monday via major online music stores and music streaming services.
And that'll be all for our Career Trending segment today. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Walter, and we'll talk to you next time.
See you next time.
We've come now to our Wednesday segment, Korea Book Club, exploring the world of Korean literature through works available in translation. And we do that with the help of our literary critic, Barry Welsh, who has once again joined us in the studio today. Barry, hello. It's great to see you.
Yes, good evening again, Jang-ho. Great to see you.
So what do you have for us today then, Barry?
So today we're reviewing a short story called Human Decency, or Ingane Dehan Yei, by one of Korea's most successful writers for a very long time, Gong Ji-young. And Gong is one of the key writers of the 386 generation of writers, which we've mentioned before. The 386 generation is this group of people who were born in the 60s and were politically active and influential in the democracy movement in the 80s and were shaping Korea's politics and social life when they were in their 30s in the 1990s. It's quite a common sort of expression. And you know, also for writers, there's these writers like Gong who are associated with the 386 generation. And she's also sort of seen by many as one of the trailblazing or leading female writers of her generation, along with people like Shin Kyung-suk And she made her debut back in 1988 and has published several very successful best-selling novels, many of which have been made into films, including her debut novel Go Alone Like a Rhino Horn, or Musoi Bulchorom Honjaso Kara, and Our Happy Time, Uri Duri Hinbokhang Shigan, and also The Crucible, which the Korean title is Dogani.
Right. In fact, I understand that the story we're talking about today, though, is seen as one of Kong's key short stories, right?
Yeah, right. So that's true. So Human Decency, it's one of her, probably one of her most famous short stories. It was initially published back in 1993. The English translation is by Bruce and Ju-Chan Fulton, the acclaimed and very prolific translators of many books and volumes of Korean literature. And the English translation was first published back in 1997 in the Wayfarer collection, and then again in 2006 as part of the Jimun Dang collection, and then again in the Modern Korean Literature collection. And I think the reason it keeps getting republished is because it finds Gong sort of reckoning with Korea's turbulent modern history, with the democratic movement of the 80s, and then with the sort of relative prosperity going into the 90s, and trying to come to terms with the role that her generation played in these sort of pivotal historical events.
Okay, so with all that in mind then, can you tell us more about what this story, Human Decency, is about? How does Kong reflect on the role of the 386 generation in modern Korean history?
Okay, so it's the early 90s, and the protagonist is a young or youngish woman who works as a journalist and feature writer for a women's magazine. As the story begins, she's working on two assignments. The first assignment is to interview a former labour activist and protester called Kwon Ogyu. And Kwon was imprisoned for 20 years at the age of 28 and has recently been released and has published a book that hasn't sold particularly well. And this interview is a chance for him to promote his life story, his book, and the charity work that he does. And his story is desperately sad. Many of the people who were arrested alongside Kwon, they were executed or tortured or simply died in prison. And the journalist is moved by her interview with Kwon, but she's also struck by the futility of his position. It seems like people aren't interested in his story. Mm. But it does cause her to reflect on the people that she herself has lost. She was an activist in the 80s, and she reflects on, the Hubei who was killed by a tear gas canister, and the friend who was taken away and tortured and later committed suicide, the other friend who was killed by a riot police by being struck by a metal baton. And she wonders at the worth of her job now. She has this quite decent career, and she thinks, has she abandoned her principles? Was her activist youth worth the pain and loss that these other people have experienced, and people like Kwon? And these questions are then sort of further highlighted and contrasted through the second person that she sent to interview.
Right, okay, so the first interview is with this activist who's been through some of the darkest times in modern Korean history, along with the protagonist herself. So what about the second interview then? Who does the protagonist interview next, and how does that compare to the first interview?
Right, so the other assignment that she has is to interview Yi Min-ja, who is kind of a lifestyle and a meditation guru. Yi Min-ja has recently returned to Korea from a kind of spiritual sojourn to India and to various countries in Africa and several other places. And the journalist's editor, the editor of this women's magazine, has become a fan of Yi's teachings. And Yi's book is a bestseller, and this so because her book is a bestseller and her editor likes her so much, the article on the labor activist is kind of put on the back burner in favor of this sort of best-selling meditation expert instead. And when the journalist interviews Yi, she comes across sharply different from Kwon, from the labour activist. So she radiates contentment and inner peace and tranquility. And the journalist is drawn to Yi, feels inspired by her. But at the same time, she has this sort of feeling of resentment. So Yi left Korea during the 80s to travel the world and find this inner peace. And in contrast, you know, the journalist, this unnamed female journalist who writes for the magazine, she sort of suffered through the 80s as an activist, you know, engaging in these sort of protests and things. And ultimately, she realizes that perhaps people don't care now. She asks at one point, "Hadn't I escaped the 1980s, that decade to which I had consigned my 20s? The dead were dead, and those who had been released from jail were free. The readers of our magazine didn't care for that sort of story anymore. It was a hit song whose time had passed. And what did this mean for me?"
Indeed. So what does it mean for her? What is Kong trying to say about her generation and Korean society after the 80s then, Barry?
So there's a lot of, you know, thorny and complicated questions in this story. And one of the main questions which is explicitly addressed is this idea of, can we ever escape the 1980s? Can, you know, Gong's generation, can they escape the 1980s? And even has Korean society, have we escaped the 1980s and moved on? And the journalist realizes that now in the 90s, at this point in the story, people laugh at the thought of political movements, of political activism. And she realizes society has moved on, but what it has moved on to was it worth fighting for? Was it worth all the sacrifices that her friends and herself made? And she calls the 90s this decade of great ambition, but then she rants about, you know, we've arrived in this decade of great ambition, but, you know, she's sort of angry about the discrimination that women face in the home and the workplace and cultural life, and the sort of kind of silly and empty articles that she's writing for this magazine. And she's raging against, you know, commercialization and consumerism that she's sort of seeing around her. And she says, We speak not of what is right and wrong, but of what we like and dislike." And near the end of the story, she sort of recognises or comes to this realisation that at least now it's possible for Lee Min-ja to be different. She can, you know, teach people meditation, and she can tell lonely people they're valuable and that their life is worth something. But there's also this sort of clear condemnation of the direction that Korean society took in the 90s, and the idea that these lifestyle gurus, although they can be helpful, they're just sort of helping people cope with this fundamentally flawed society, and that perhaps the activists of the 80s, like Gong and like the story's protagonist, perhaps they failed and they lost their ideals and lost their dreams.
Yes, it sounds like a very powerful story. Perhaps not the most subtle of comparisons or observations when we look at it today, but I imagine at the time when it was first published in 1993, it would have been considered more groundbreaking or astute, shall we say. But I would say it is perhaps still relevant today, perhaps even more so as we get further away from the struggles of the 80s. It's such a different world now, even compared to the 90s. Mm-hmm. When we compare it to the 80s, it's even more so. Mm-hmm. Although there is that perhaps a guilt that we might perhaps feel less directly now that we're further away. But Korean people, I still think it's very, very aware of it. Would you say it is still a very relevant work today?
Right, sure. It's definitely a story that's still worth reading. And I think the things that she identifies, the problems that she identifies, it's so interesting to see those things are still exist in some form around us now. Like, she's sort of, you know, angry about the way that, consumerism, became such a big thing, and the commercialization of life, right? And that's certainly something that we can see around us. Even the sort of trend for lifestyle gurus and the benefit that they add, or, you know, the purpose that those types of people play in our lives, that's certainly something we can see around us as well. Also, this isn't there hidden in this idea that subconsciously or embedded in our culture, or maybe in Korean culture, is this idea that, you know, something has been lost, right? And that the trajectory or the path that could have been traveled, that maybe things veered off, right? Maybe not the best direction. You know, you have Lee Min-ja, who's meant to be the sort of spiritual guide, right? But she's sort of preaching like meditation and things to the sort of consumer society. And maybe we could have had a society more based on those principles instead of the sort of consumerist things that Gong sort of identifies at the end of the story.
Sure. The fact that we're talking about this, I think, still so much here today shows the power of this work, that it brings up these sorts of ideas that we can still question them today. It's a fascinating book. It's called Human Decency by Kong Jiang. Barry, I'm afraid that is. We're going to leave it today. And it's also the last time we're seeing you this year, right? Anton will be coming next week to do his usual monthly slot. So I just want to say thank you for another wonderful year with us, Barry, and for introducing us to all the books that you have this year. Have a great Christmas and New Year, and we'll see you again in 2022.
Okay, you too. Merry Christmas. 춤추듯 날린 꽃잎 위로 그대의
My name is Son Tae-jin. You're now listening to Korea 24.
We've come now to our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers here in Korea, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald, who we thank for providing us with early editions of their papers to make this segment possible. And looking through those papers for us is, of course, our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Che, who has joined us now in the studio. Mark, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. You're wearing a scarf today. Are you a little chilly?
I am a little chilly. Yeah. It does get a little bit cold here in this studio, but it's definitely cold outside as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Mark, what have you brought for us today?
We're going to head to the People's section of the Korea Times. Jung Da-min writes about her recent trip to Egypt, and one of her most memorable parts of the trip was a fascinating individual, Ezzeldin Al-Hassan Soliman. The Egypt native is a veteran guide with a Korean tour interpreter license, the very first ever, in fact. The veteran guide, indeed, as Ezzeldin, has been giving tours in fluent Korean to countless tour groups since 1999. Now, to give you an idea of his fluency, Jung recalls that during their tour, Ezzeldin referred to a flail, it's a kind of farming tool, to a dorike, but then he had a hard time remembering what the word was in Arabic. So that's pretty funny.
Sure, that happens to me sometimes as well. But wow, an Egyptian providing Korean language tour guides and services to Korean tour groups. That's pretty amazing. Imagine there must have been some sort of application or perhaps authentication process that might have been quite difficult to get through.
Absolutely, really tough. He was turned down left and right, and he credits three, what he calls miracles, for him to land the job. The first miracle was it happened after a Korean travel agency linked up with an Egyptian agency. The Korean agency, they wanted a Korean guide who gave tours in Korean. But the Egyptian agency, they misunderstood, thinking that they were looking for an Egyptian who could give tours in Korean. Now, you think that the Korean agency, they would ask for credentials, of course, but then an explosion caused the electricity line to be cut, so his information, it couldn't be faxed out.
Wow.
Now, the second miracle was, on his very first tour, there wasn't a staff member from said Korean agency to check up on things, who probably raised an issue right then and there, right? Mm. Now, the last miracle was that his tour group was amazing. When the Korean agency finally received the facts of the situation days later, they immediately contacted the tour group, who said they were more than satisfied. Mm. So that was pretty amazing. Now, I wish I had more time to talk about Ezzeldin, because Jung gets into the challenges of learning Korean and how he landed a radio job in KBS's Arabic department. What? Excuse me? When I read that, I was like, excuse me?
But so he was just down the office.
At some point, right? Right. But learn more about him, you got to pick up tomorrow's Times. It was a really fun story.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a fun one. Seriously, imagine going on a tour to Egypt and then imagine seeing an Egyptian tour guide speaking in Korean for Korean tourists. That would be something quite amazing, especially learning the history from a local as well.
That's right.
Let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
So we're going to head to the culture section of tomorrow's Korea Herald. Now, if our listeners have heard some of the show's Korea Book Club, they'll learn that South Korean-made science fiction, it is excellent stuff. I mean, you've talked about it on the show.
Sure.
It's really good stuff. So you can imagine my reaction to Lee Si-jin's piece in tomorrow's Herald that sets us up for The Silent Sea. It's a South Korean original sci-fi thriller coming out on Netflix this Friday. The Silent Sea is an adaptation of a short film of the same name by director Choi Hang-yong. It's about a group of space explorers sent on a classified mission to an abandoned research facility on the moon. And that's it, Jung-ho. I saw the preview myself. It shows you so much and so little at the same time. Also super scary. Yeah.
Right. It always has to be an abandoned facility, doesn't it? Anyway, many eyes, I'm sure, will be focused on this 8-episode series, not only because it follows other Korean-made Netflix sensations like Squid Game and Hellbound, but also because some of the names associated with it.
That's absolutely right. Many will recognize Train to Busan's Gong Yoo, who also was in Squid Game for a little bit, as well as Hollywood veteran Bae Doona. Of course, she's done many other things. But others will also recognize Ho Sung-tae, who was the tattooed gangster in Squid Game. His role is very different from the preview. It's pretty fascinating. Now, when we're talking about behind the camera, director Choi needed help expanding his original short film. It was only 37 minutes long, I believe. So he teamed up with Park Eun-gyo. Now, she co-wrote Bong Joon-ho's 2009 thriller, Mother. To this day, many critics, they still say that that might even be Bong Joon-ho's strongest piece. So, this could really be something.
Yeah, excitement is certainly building over this new series. We'll leave it there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
And that wraps things up for our show today as well. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so do join us again then to continue to get your daily dose of Korean news analysis. Until then, we hope you have a great day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.